Portion Podcast, a weekly look at the Parshat HaShavua, the weekly Torah portion. I'm Aaron Roller, here with my co-host, Rabbi Jonathan Bienenfeld.
Howdy.
It's totally different. We're earlier in the week. It is daylight hours. Do you think this is going to bring the podcast a different energy?
Absolutely.
You're feeling it already?
I already can, despite the fact that we are huddled down in a basement and barely know that it's light outside. I can still feel and feed off that energy.
I think I'm still riding high on my morning coffee, maybe. So that's going to play into things, possibly. All right. So this week, Avraham Avinu is out of the picture. We've been with him for 3 weeks, and now we're moving on to the next of the patriarchs, Yitzhak Avinu.
Isn't it remarkable how, when we think about which figures occupy a lot of space and which figures occupy very little space, and I think we'll talk about that in focusing on the life of Yitzhak, that, like you said, three weeks. Wow, Avraham's tenure is now, everything that we know about Avraham is effectively boiled down into Torah portions that take all of 3 weeks to read in shul. It's just remarkable how little we know about people who were so formative and made such an impact and indeed founded all of Judaism, and how little we really know about them.
Right.
We will zero in on some little episode and some little anecdote and just, you know, beat it to death. And yet there are years and years and years of Avraham's life that just go completely uncharted and aren't picked up on at all by the Torah.
Well, that gets into something I was thinking about, which is that for all of his influence, and we did argue that he might be the most influential person to ever live.
Indeed.
There are no movies.
Yeah.
Has Avraham ever been depicted in a mainstream, in like a real Hollywood film?
I hope not. And while we're on the air, may I ask that you never do so?
I don't think that I'll ever have the opportunity to produce an Avraham Avinu film. But why do you think that would be a bad thing?
I just think that these are figures that are just too large for the screen. And I think it's sort of unfortunate when we take, you know, what Medrash does is that it tries to crawl into the very, very terse amount of information that we really have about any of these people. And it tries to sort of expand their influence a little bit. And so often they brush up against each other, right? And that at least factually or historically, they can't even all be possible, right, in a historical context, but that the lessons that are derived are nonetheless important. Meaning to say that even if, let's say, two different episodes couldn't possibly have taken place in the life of Avraham Avinu, because of the way the Torah depicts his life and because of the way that the Torah speaks about his life, the Torah is intentionally ambiguous enough to make it possible, because this is the kind of figure that Avraham was. And I think that when we see something, whether it's a documentary or even something that we know is meant to be taken more loosely, it's hard to not allow it to become a more concrete version of the way we start to think about these people in our own minds. And I think there's something said about that.
It sounds like a extreme version of what my mother will say when it comes to seeing a film adaptation of any book, where, you know, I don't want it to be what was in my imagination should be taken and fixed on the screen.
Mom, if you're listening, that's exactly what I meant. Brilliant as always.
I don't know, though. I think the opportunity to kind of get the message out there. But on the other hand, the interior shots would be difficult.
What do you mean by that?
Avraham was, you know, he was very intense.
Oh, Lord, we have got to stop doing this.
I think one pun per episode is good. And we left one out last week. But anyway, so moving on.
He was intense. Oh, good heavens.
So Yitzhak Avinu, everything we know about Yitzhak really comes almost from half of this week's Parsha.
Right. Yeah, there's very little. There's very little that we know about Yitzhak. We know less about Yitzhak than any of the other two patriarchs, but we know less about Yitzhak than almost any other important biblical character, important biblical personality. We know very, very little about Yitzhak.
He says very little.
He does very little. And I think one of the things that maybe is so compelling and so interesting is that so much of what he does seems to mimic so closely what his father did.
So it's interesting. So I had this idea, which was not entirely mine. I think maybe it was based on Malbim. There's sort of like a one piece of Yitzhak is that he's going like, it's great to say that, you know, Avraham has this pioneering spirit and he's, you know, at the vanguard, but like, that's not a movement. A movement needs followers. And so it's just as important to have the biography of the follower in the founding documents as it is to have the life of the founder. You have a lot of movements that don't exist. They don't persist beyond the initial founding because you don't have the people who can kind of like just follow the example of the founder. Like there's just too much charisma involved. There's not enough, you know, operationalizing all the things that have to make a movement successful. And so with Yitzhak, it's perhaps the case that the Torah is showing us that no, you need a generation where there's just like going through the motions almost denigrates it, where it's like just living out the vision of what Abraham stood for.
100%. Just following the playbook. I mean, you don't even have to write a new playbook. Just following out the one that already exists is worthwhile. I think that comes down to this may very well be the most treasured and cherished and hallowed word in all of traditional Judaism. And I think, Aaron, what you're talking about is Mesorah. Right? Effectively, that Mesorah, it's, you know, it's more than tradition. It's unfortunate when Mesorah is translated as tradition. It's really more transmission. It's the idea that we have this great gift, the divine word and the manner in which we're meant to live our lives, and that is meant to be transmitted from one generation to the next. And exactly right. We need people who are willing to sort of put aside their own interest and almost their own creativity almost to some degree, and be willing to say that what I think and what I might want to do beyond the parameters of what's already been handed to me really is not as important as operating within those parameters.
That said, though, there is like, so that's on one hand, and that's, I think, trying to put it in a very, very heroic light. On the other hand, like one thing I was struck by reading the very beginning of this week's Parsha is the degree to which it, like the Parsha itself is almost, I don't know, making a mockery or just like showing the degree to which he's going through the motions. I would sort of bring as an example the second verse, the second pasuk in this week's Parsha. It says, I'll read it in English. Yitzhak entreated the Lord opposite his wife because she was barren. The Lord accepted his prayers and Rivka, his wife, conceived. So this issue of fertility, which we've discussed as it related to Abraham and Sarah, and is like a huge struggle in their life, and it occupies so much questioning of God, and it creates all this drama. For Yitzhak, it's just kind of like very perfunctory. It's summarized in one verse, and like, yeah, he had the issues of fertility, but it's like it's kind of over and done with. And that's a really, like, maybe I'm reading too much into the fact that it's just covered in one verse, but it struck me as being like, huh, like the things which were like the monumental moments and struggles of his father's life were kind of like check boxes that he's got to check off almost.
Perhaps on the other hand, I think, and this is something that I was actually, you know, mentioned this past week in Shulchan Shabbos, that to some degree, I think, you know, we don't give enough credit to, I guess we don't show enough gratitude, or we don't feel enough gratitude to Avraham for what he's done. Meaning, aside from being our father, our grandfather, our patriarch, he is the head of our nation, he's the founder of our nation. I don't know how often we reflect upon how much is just such a given to us theologically, how much has already been figured out, right? We just take it for granted in most societies, thank God, in today's day and age, that there should be, you know, equality before the law, and there should be a value placed on human life, and all the other sorts of things that are endowed to us by Abraham and by the Torah. And we don't really have to think through them especially often. We take even monotheism just for granted. These were things that Abraham really had to struggle with. Maybe quite the opposite. That's underscoring sort of the magnitude of what Abraham did and the degree of gratitude perhaps that we have to have to him, in the sense that this is a playbook. Look, in the life of Yitzchak, this all worked out very, you know, neatly, and you could sort of wrap a bow around the whole thing, at least not in terms of the actual child raising, but in terms of the child bearing, that, yeah, she was barren for a while, and then he understood that you were supposed to daven, you were supposed to pray, you're supposed to turn to God and beseech God, and then it all works out. And how does he know this? He knows this from his parents. And it is sort of a checkbox. I don't know if that's a negative as much as it's, I don't know if it's as much of a negative in the life of Yitzhak as it is a positive in terms of the message that was conveyed from his parents.
Like that he learned that this is how you deal with this.
This is how you pray.
It is what you do. All right. I hear that. I think it plays out again also when they get to Grar. And again, he very, very kind of like knee-jerk reaction says that his wife is his sister, which right. he kind of gets called out on by Avimelech, who I saw in the commentaries, I don't remember, it may have been Rashbam saying, it's not the same Avimelech. This is also the next generation. The Avimelech, father king, is the name of what they call their leader.
Which you find with Pharaoh. And
yeah,
like
and
that.
Particularly that we know that Avimelech is like, that's a name you would call your king, possibly.
It makes a lot of good sense.
Yeah.
And further, it certainly seems from the fact that he has to be told to not do this, that Yitzchak's plan was to descend further down to Egypt, much the same way that his father did. While he then stays in Gerar, the Torah makes a point of telling us that he redug all the same wells even that Abraham did. It really is following the playbook almost to a T, even with respect to those things that you wouldn't think are especially philosophically or religiously important. Yitzchak is very much trying to live out the same life that his father did.
I want to get back to the wells, but one thing I want to emphasize, something that really occurred to me a couple of years ago, and I think is so revealing, that with all of these things, there's one thing that Yitzchak does not do, and it gets to that issue of the fertility. He does not take another wife. And I think that that is so revealing in terms of, like, witnessing both the good and the negative outcomes of your parents' actions. And I suspect that Yitzhak, no matter what was going to happen, was going to be like, I'm not introducing any of that kind of drama. And it's very interesting because then you see it happen. I mean, not intentionally really, but it happens again a generation later that you have multiple wives and quite a bit of drama as well for Yaakov, which we're going to get to just next week. But I just think that it's like, you know, and I think in terms of my own family, in terms of people, friends that I know, I think that it's very possible to see things that happen one generation up. And, you know, people are often making very firm decisions based on the things that they see their parents. That's where your lessons come from. And I just think it's so interesting that of the three Avot, that Yitzhak is the one who does not marry again. And I just think that makes the most sense in the world to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it comes back to the same point that Yitzhak is learning not only from his father's successes, but also from, I don't know if, you know, failure is even the appropriate word, because all signs pointed at every single turn to this is what Abraham should have done. But this is the, I guess this is the predicament that we're sort of always in, is that without necessarily second guessing the decisions that were made by previous generations, nevertheless, what lessons can we derive from it? Meaning, if my father had lived in my life, right, if my father was in my shoes, would he have made the same decision? Or with the blessing of hindsight, would he have recognized the pitfalls? It is a remarkable thing that as much as the Torah never actually forbids polygamy, we don't seem to have, at least not that I can recall, we don't seem to have a single incident in which it works out well, neither in Chumash nor in the Bible in its entirety. It's always a disaster. There's always strife. There's always difficulty. There's always tension. As much as there are some wonderful products and wonderful benefits, obviously in the case of Yaakov, in the case of Rachel and Leah, producing a much more robust Jewish people than could have been accomplished, it would seem, with one wife alone. But that there's always strife, it never works out very well. And obviously our custom, shall we say, today, is that we are very much monogamous.
There are plenty of families that are producing 12 kids with just one husband and wife, though. But
thank God. Keep growing, Klaisrael.
Right. Ken Yerbu. Anyway, so getting to who their children are, and they only have children, I mean, they have one set of twins, Yaakov and Esav, and it plants this central dichotomy, central struggle into sort of in archetypes in the way we think about like the Jews and Esav. There's this real. I mean, it's in the Torah from the minute we hear about her pregnancy. They're struggling in her womb to a point where she doesn't. She can't even grasp what's going on. It seems so hard to understand and so difficult, and to the point, I mean, all kinds of different interpretations. And so when she says, like, if this is what's happening, I think the first translating very, very strictly from Hebrew is like, why am I? And then the, you know, different commentaries say, you know, why am I pregnant or why am I alive? Not that she has death wish, but like, what did I get myself into? And the answer is, well, you have two struggling nations that are always going to be struggling. And it sets us up for something, which I'm going to, like, let me pose it to you as a question. On the one hand, it's set up in that text, two nations struggling. On the other hand, I think we're going to see as the text goes on that Esav gets kind of a bad rap in terms of there's a lot of things which the Medrash elaborates on or kind of explains that, you know, puts him in a very bad light. If you just read the verses in the Torah straight, doesn't sound so bad, and almost sounds the other way around. Like Esav is almost an innocent guy. And so, you know, one example I think we could just jump to is the selling of the birthright. Your brother comes in, he says, oh, I am famished, I am on the brink of starvation. And you say, okay, well, you know how you're the oldest and you're supposed to get a double portion through the laws of inheritance. Maybe that's anachronistic. That's certainly the Torah's laws. There's certainly an expectation in the way this is traditionally understood that it means that there's a double portion for the oldest son. You give me the double portion, so I'll get 2/3 of the estate when dad passes away, and you get 1/3. I mean, that's a pretty, on the face of it, that's kind of like a not such a nice thing to do. Why don't you just give your brother a drink of water and, you know, pour him some Gatorade or something?
Well, in reverse, what does it say about Esav? And the Torah is pretty clear about what it has to say about Esav. What does it say about Esav that he was willing to sell that birthright for a bowl of lentils?
Yeah, that's nice. And they say that's why they call him Edom, that he got the nickname for it. They're like, oh, look at that guy who sold the birthright for a bowl of lentils. But on the other hand, he says, like, you know, and this is like, I mean, this parsha, I don't know if more than others, but like, it's really, really stark the degree to which we read the things that it says, and we read them in such a way that they have implications for like through the centuries for Jewish history, that they are, like I said, they're archetypical.
Right.
And so, like, we on one hand, this is a perfect example where on the one hand you could say, yeah, like, he completely denigrates the idea of birthright, and he says, like, oh, I'm going to die anyway, right? He says, I'm going to die anyway, so, like, what does it matter? And we take that statement and say it means that he only believes in this world. He doesn't believe in there being another world. He doesn't care about the tradition of his father and grandfather. On the other hand, he's, like, might just be saying, like, well, if my choices are selling the birthright or dying of starvation, I might as well sell the birthright because I don't want to die. Like there's a way in reading these things which are so, you know, on the most basic literal level, where he doesn't seem like such a bad guy. And I'm not saying that, by the way, to make an argument in favor of him being misunderstood necessarily, as much as it is to, I guess, question why that. Like, I don't have an issue with the way that the Parsha and everything around that has been read for centuries within Jewish tradition. But it's more to, I don't think that the tension is unintentional. Like, I think the Torah is written a certain way, and our interpretations are a certain way, and the interpretations very much exist within counterpoint of the text not painting him in the negative light that that traditionally we see him in. I don't know why that is necessarily, but I think that's very real.
I think that this is often the case when it comes to Medrash, when it comes to further elaboration and explanation, that certainly what takes place in Medrash is that the sages would pick up on more vague kinds of references that exist in the verses themselves and then exploit them. Right, and show that, like you said, that it's that it becomes an archetype of something much, much larger, that there is no, you know, interaction. Maybe let's just go back for a minute. You know, commented before on, it's really remarkable how little we actually know about Abraham, and we're really just given, I mean, over the course of a very, very long life, we're just given a handful of episodes. It's sort of like Abraham's greatest hits, perhaps, but it's not exactly an ongoing and exhaustive chronology of how he lived out his every day. And what we're given, it would seem, are the sorts of things that can tell us and give us greater insight into his personality, because they're very typical of the kind of person that he was. I think in the same vein, we presume that every interaction that the Torah presents us with, if this is the 15-minute conversation or the 4.5-minute conversation that the Torah wants us to know existed between Yaakov and Esav, then it's because this is typical of their personality types. I do think you're giving Esav a little bit more of a free pass than he deserves. I think there's some interpretation almost that you might be making of the psukim themselves, meaning if we'll read the psukim very, very literally, Esav doesn't say, "I'm dying of starvation." Esav doesn't say that I've been outside for, you know, 2 weeks and I lost my camping party and he comes in all bedraggled. He says that I'm ayef, I'm tired. What's actually fascinating, I always find this interesting, something I think about every year, and I'm not sure that I have, a greater answer this year than I did last year, but the Torah, as you mentioned, refers from this point on to Esav as Edom, as sort of the red one, because of this pot of red lentils. It's not because he sold the birthright for the pot of red lentils. That way that the verse actually runs is Vayomer Esav El Yaakov. Esav said to Yaakov, "Hav iteni na min ha'adom ha'adom hazeh. Pour some of that very red stuff down into my gullet, ki ayef anochi, because I'm tired. Al-Kain Karashimo Edom, therefore we call him Edom, not because he sold it, but because of the request. And because the request is made in such a almost grotesque, hedonistic kind of manner that, what, because you're tired, therefore just pour this down my gullet? And it's at that point that maybe Yaakov seizes upon this opportunity to say, "I don't like where this is going." the idea that you are going to be the guy who represents the Jewish people in the land of Israel with a double portion and all of that, I can't allow that to happen. And the way that the Torah actually views it is that, Vayivez Esav Esav Bichora, that Esav sort of he spurned the birthright, he degraded the birthright in this entire encounter.
So I think that's a good point. One thing, though, that is sort of inferred in what you said in terms of Yaakov saying, "Well, I don't want, you know, you representing the Jewish people and the land of Israel and all that," is this question about what the Behora is versus what we're going to get to at the end of the parsha of what the Bracha is. That, like, are they the same thing? I think when I was young, you know, when I was in school, we were kind of taught that later on in the parsha where, you know, Yaakov, he puts on the goat skin, so he feels like Esav, and he kind of tricks his father into giving him this blessing. I kind of recall learning when I was in grade school that, no, it was okay that he did it because he had sold the Bechorah. But I think reading more closely as an adult, it looks like they're not the same thing.
I don't think they are the same thing. Perhaps that one tracks the other, or that it stands to reason that he who has the Bechorah, who has the, I guess, the right of the firstborn, should be the one to receive those brachos, those blessings, that they may go hand in hand. By the way, upon, and I don't know that we have the ability to really do this, you know, in audio on a podcast, but upon a very close reading of the blessing that Isaac presents to Jacob when he believes Jacob to actually be Esau, and then the blessing that he gives Jacob when he knows that it's Jacob and it's just that he's departing for Laban's home, it's not even clear what the blessing was intended to be. What is the blessing about? What does it harp on?
Which one? The first one or the second one?
Meaning the first one in the light of the second one. When he gives the first one, thinking that it's Esav, and I would encourage everybody to take a look at these psukim themselves at the very end of this week's parsha. But that when he thinks it's Esav, he gives him a blessing that is replete with all of the material and worldly goods and military might and muscle that you would need to present someone with in order to be able to create a physically secure society. And then Esav comes in and he says, "Can I have a blessing too?" He says, "No, sorry, I'm fresh out. Like, I gave it already." And yet when Yaakov comes back as Yaakov and Yitzchak knows that it's Yaakov, he's got another blessing and he's ready to give it to him. And that that involves the sort of the more spiritual dimensions of inheriting Abraham and being the torchbearer for the Jewish people and the spiritual capacity that we think of.
Maybe this is getting too far into the weeds, and it's probably a lot of commentaries on this. But is it that there's one which is that like the firstborn gets a double portion of the inheritance, and the inheritance could be physical, the inheritance could be spiritual. I mean, it could sort of work on multiple planes. And then there's the question of and thus far, like between Avraham and Yitzhak, we didn't hear anything, or Yitzhak versus Yishmael, we didn't hear anything about there being a Bechorah in the past, right? This is the first time the idea of Bechorah, of the right of the firstborn, is mentioned. Then there's an idea of a bracha, of a blessing, and obviously the words are very similar. They're the same word with just the two middle letters reversed, where it's the idea of like you're carrying this mantle of the Jewish people. Those are right, like you said, one might track the other, but they're not the same. And what it seems is happening is that Yitzhak is giving, he calls Esav because he says, I want to give you the bracha, right? He says, I want to give you the bechorah?
Bracha.
Right. He says, I want to give you the bracha. That's not the bechorah.
That's not the bechorah.
And Esav doesn't seem to think that it is the bechorah because he says, I've been deceived twice. First Yaakov takes my bechorah, then he takes the bracha. So there's acknowledgement on Esav's part that these are not the same things. But so then there's this other blessing then at the end before Yaakov leaves town to get away from his brother, which you would think then, right? So if the bracha is the more spiritual one,
actually seem to be more spiritual.
Doesn't sound more spiritual.
Because the more spiritual blessing actually comes to Yaakov at the very end of the parsha, when Yitzchak knows that he's speaking to Yaakov. It's only there that he says, may he grant you the blessing of Abraham to you and to your offspring with you. It sounds like he is meant to be the inheritor of all of the spiritual goodness that is to devolve upon the leader of the Jewish people, what we would call the Jewish people. I know that's anachronistic. And it would seem then that it's more that the political, military, physical sustenance and blessing that Yitzchak originally intends to give Esav perhaps tracks the Bechorah. If you're going to have the land, then here's what you need the land. You'll need to secure the land. You'll need the land to prove profitable. You'll need the land to be able to satisfy you, meaning your actual needs, your hunger, and all of that. And that's what Yitzchak is providing, he believes, Esav with, but lo and behold, he's providing that to Yaakov. But actually, Yaakov is the one who really needs that as well, because he's the one who overtook or bargained for the Bechorah, for the birthright.
So I have two thoughts on that. Number one, it struck me that it talks about, when talking about the way that these children, young men, are favored by their parents, it says Yitzchak loved Esav because game was in his mouth, right? That he's always feeding him, he's hunting, and he's giving him the food that he gets. But Rivka loved Yaakov, and it doesn't say why she loves Yaakov. This made me think about, there's a teaching in Pirkei Avot, in Ethics of the Father, that says any love which is based upon a thing is ultimately not going to last, and any love which is not based on anything, it's just I love you because I love you, there's no reason, that's a real love that's going to last. It struck me as being very, like that would seem to be illustrated over here and illustrative of what you're saying, that ultimately, and there's in the intervening verses, we find out that Yitzhak is very disappointed at Esav's choice of wives, and he may sort of get wise to the fact that he's maybe engaging in idolatry, not such a moral guy. But the point is that then this idea that he loves him because he's always feeding him is a love which ultimately doesn't stand the test of time, which enables him to then give this extra level of blessing to Yaakov as Yaakov. I don't know. I never heard that before. Have you heard that those two ideas tied together?
Meaning the psukim here with the Mishnah in
Pirkei Avos. Yeah.
I don't. If I have, then I don't recall. But I think you're right.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
But I mean, just consider that. Doesn't that, I guess, taken strictly, I mean, what kind of light does that paint Yitzchak in? If we really take that as literally as it sounds, or I guess if we take that as simply as it sounds, so was I guess, was Yitzchak such a simpleton so as to have greater love for somebody who feeds him well, and yet Rivka is the one who I guess can see to the real core of her two sons and appreciate Yaakov on a level that Yitzchak doesn't?
So I think this is a place where the Medrash comes into play, right? That Esav would kind of would be trying to talk Torah with him, would be trying to engage him in these conversations. He was sort of faking, but would ask these the Medrash kind of talks about
that. Yeah, and look, and I think that helps. I guess that helps to soften the blow. But I don't really believe that it's fair to to view Yitzchak as someone. First of all, in terms of just the respect that we have for Yitzchak, to say that he could be so easily cheated and so easily tricked, I think that Yitzchak knew the score, knew what was going on. I think Yitzchak appreciated what Esav was capable of. I think he recognized his talents. And yes, perhaps the fact that he also spoke Torah doesn't make him the scholar and the genius and the spiritual great that he knows his son Yaakov to be, but that Esav has his place. And I think let's just try to connect all those dots if that be the case.
Oh, and that's exactly where I was. I that was the other point that I wanted to raise from that, which is that there is this idea, definitely don't have the sources, but there's the idea that Yaakov, the goal, there's sort of an overarching idea that the goal is to try to have children who are both on board with the Abrahamic message of monotheism and the ethics and all the so that Avraham doesn't get it because he has Ishmael who's kind of not on board, and then that theoretically that Esav is also supposed to be a patriarch, that there's the potential there, and that right. And that especially for within a character study of Yitzchak as a person who is on the quieter side, who is perhaps blind at this point. We know that he goes blind later, and then there's an idea that he's been blind since the time of the binding of Isaac, that having two sons, each of whom will be a spiritual successor, but one of whom is on the more ethereal side, on the more spiritual side, and one of whom is about trying to find the holiness in the physical, that they're both good, but he would relate to the one who is who's the one who's out in the field. Not relate to him, but he would be more excited by that because that's so far from his own personality.
Perhaps more excited by that. Perhaps just recognizing those talents for what they are. Meaning, irrespective of whom Yitzchak, I guess, more closely aligns or who he finds more glamorous or enticing in terms of these two different personality traits, I would suggest that Yitzchak views his two sons as being two very different personalities, two very different characters, but why not have something of a tag team? Who's to say that in the next generation there needs to be only, we think about three patriarchs and four matriarchs. Who's to say? Maybe at this point, Yitzchak views there being the possibility of four patriarchs in three generations. And what that looks like is that Esav would carry the mantle of the more physical, as you said, and that Yaakov would carry the mantle of the more spiritual, and yet what Yaakov and Rivka see is that this is an impossibility, meaning to say there has to be a certain baseline degree of respect, of love, of adherence to the most basic ethical, moral, spiritual values that have been preached by the two generations prior. And Rivka is able to see Esav beyond his talents, beyond his capacity of being a great provider, as being somebody who really has not imbibed that message to the degree necessary to form that sort of partnership with Yaakov, so that Esav is meant to have the b'chora. He's meant to receive the spiritual, the military might and all the physical and material wealth and sustenance, be the one who provides that to Yaakov. And Yaakov is the ish tam yoshev ohalim. He's the bookworm and he's the scholar and he's the one who's going to continue studying, and he'll be supported materially by his brother. And Yaakov and Rivka don't see that as being feasible. And in that regard, They do, it seems, see something that Yitzchak is not able to.
Well, I don't know if it's that they – do you think it's that they see it that it's not possible, or it's not possible for Esav?
Not possible for Esav. We actually have a tradition that this works out, actually, one generation later.
All right, that's where I was going with it also.
Right. This is the great partnership between Yisachar and Zevulun, where we say that Zevulun are the ones who sort of support their brother Yisachar. Yisachar is the one who is in the study hall, who's in the yeshiva, and they're learning and they're studying and developing into great scholars. And Zvulun, although, you know, perhaps no slouches in their own right, see themselves as being capable of providing materially and physically for Yisachar's needs, so that they are the great merchants and that Yisachar becomes the great scholars.
I was actually going to say that that's true. That is sort of the Yisachar and Zvulun do stand out to us as the one brother who's studying and the other one who's earning and helping to support his brother. But I was going to say that it plays out, I think that a similar dynamic is playing out in the tension between Joseph and his brothers.
Uh-huh.
That they, I think there's one way of reading it, you know, where they are suspecting him of being an Esav type character, a person who doesn't, not necessarily for the same reasons as Esav, but a person whose character doesn't really, doesn't measure up and isn't good. Yeah. And so anyway, we'll talk about that as we go forward. But I think that does beg the question, what's the value of like favoring one child over the other at all? Forget about the reasons. And this one likes that one better. That one likes the other one better. Like, you have children. This seems like textbook, not great parenting.
So I wonder, you know, the word ahava, much like the word sinna, for whatever reason, we don't have this really robust lexicon of words to use, I think, the same way that we do in English. To say that you like something would be ohave, and to say that you love something would be ohave. To say that maybe you favor something would be ohave, and to say that you find something, much the same way when we speak about a wife that is less loved. The word snu'ah is used. Does snu'ah mean that that the person who's married to two wives actually detests and loathes his other wife, loves one and absolutely detests the other? Or does it mean sort of favoring in one capacity, not favoring in the other capacity? I don't really know that when we say that Yitzchak sort of had a fond place in his heart for Esav because of what he was capable of doing, and that Rivka tended to, I guess, align herself more with Yaakov. Does that mean that they didn't love the other? I don't know. That's hard for me to believe.
No, but even if you play favorites a little bit, it can, you know, kids are pretty perceptive about these things. Anyway, let's is there anything to say about Yitzchak and Rivka's trip to Grar? That's kind of, you know, we get the story about the selling of the Bechora. Then we take this interlude where we get kind of the bulk of what we're going to learn about Yitzchak's life, which is that it's a time of famine. He goes to Grar, and he claims that his wife is his sister. He gets called out on it, but Avimelech, the king here, is extremely gracious about it. He says, "Oh, you were worried that someone was going to kill you because they wanted to marry your wife. All right, well, guess what? I'm the ruler here. What I say goes, and it's, you know, no one's allowed to touch you. To, you know, this man must be left alone."
Either gracious or he's just a great politician.
Well, those things don't have to be mutually exclusive,
right? Only today.
Just the intent. Yeah. Well, but the then Yitzchak has like very kind of mysteriously, miraculously successful produce. It says he plants and he gets a hundredfold yield from what would normally grow.
Right, which is where the term and the name of the city or the neighborhood of Mea Shearim comes from.
Right, and so then you get the moment where they're kind of like looking askance at him. They're kind of giving him side eye for the fact that he's so wealthy. And Avimelech says, you know, maybe it's not the best idea for you to stay here. You've grown too big for us. And is this the first incidence of anti-Semitism where, you know, Yitzchak could say, well, what do you mean? I'm from here also. Like, I was born in Canaan. I'm one of you guys. And they're like, well, you are, but also you're really not. I don't know. Do you see that as being kind of like I see it as being like a prototypical, anti-Semitic move on the part of the folks from Grar.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there is any other instance of it. I mean, Avraham is mistreated, you know, to some degree when he goes down to Egypt. But you don't really get the impression that he's any more mistreated than anybody else would have been who comes down with a beautiful wife and claims that no, we're actually not married at all, and you know, then ends up leaving, much to the embarrassment of the king and the government, and he's sent off with all these gifts, and you know, we didn't mean anything by it. Please don't have your lord smite us or anything like that. But this does feel different. It really does feel different. It feels like being mistreated for what? Because I'm successful. Now, look, there's something about, I guess, just part of the innate human experience that we tend to be jealous of those who are right next to us and yet have more than us. So if Yitzhak had been a member of any other nation or just had sort of been an outsider, and then the next thing you know, this kind of sort of outsider becomes a very wealthy and very successful person in our own midst, would the reaction have been the same? I'm not sure exactly, but it is one that certainly resonates as being the kind of thing that we've had to deal with again and again and again throughout history, almost whether a matter of being too poor or too wealthy, we can never quite strike the exact balance and be exactly the kind of people that the host culture around us claim that if only you were this kind of person and only you were this kind of people, then we could finally get along.
That gets into the idea that for so much of his life, he's going through the motions, following in the footsteps of his father, uncovering the wells his father dug. And then finally, you know, he's got to leave Grar and he kind of goes a little bit away and the wells are contested, and he goes further away and the wells are contested. And then finally he digs the wells himself. He digs his own wells. And like I said, I think it's the Malbim, but there's definitely an idea that, you know, once he kind of takes matters into his own hand and he digs his own wells as opposed to uncovering the wells of his father or having his servants dig the wells. But once he gets kind of steps up and digs his own wells, then he's able to stand on his own. And then you have Avimelech coming back and saying, oh, I want to make a peace treaty with you. I realize that you're blessed by God.
It's actually the Ramban.
It's the Ramban?
It's the Ramban.
I'll have to look at the Malbim also, see if there's something there that I'm thinking Ramban, about. But okay. So yeah, the Ramban, Nachmanides, talks about that. That's kind of the key. And I don't know. I kind of take from that something similar in terms of a lesson about autonomy, that you've got to really not that he wasn't before and you know, he had to kind of back off, but like in being yourself, like you've got to say, who am I? What do I need to do? And he, you know, again, it's, you know, digging your own well, like there's something that seems like a metaphor that you can really take to the bank. Like you got to stand up, like meaning standing up for yourself, doing your own thing, not, you know, he's, you know, doing the same thing. I mean, you know, Avraham certainly dug wells, but he's digging his own and he's becoming his own person through it and gains a degree of respect and autonomy as a result.
You know, the Ramban, while we're on the topic, the Ramban is the great advocate for one of the most fascinating phenomena that take place throughout the entire Bible, which is the phenomenon of Maase Avos Simen Labanim. I think we may have spoken about this previously.
We definitely have.
But the idea that what occurs to this first these first few generations and the founding fathers of and founding mothers of Judaism really continues to play itself out again and again and again over the course of time, even down into our generation. And isn't this something that we are always wondering about? To what degree does the state of Israel, to what degree does it stand up for itself and recognize the importance or the need of going it alone and doing what it needs to do, let's say, to be able to protect itself? And to what degree do you look over your shoulder and make sure that all of your allies still agree, and that what you're doing is not only actually correct, but also perceived as, let's say, politically correct by surrounding nations? And this is something that we're always sort of struggling with. But I do think that certainly on a very basic level, that the message that the Ramban reads into these psukim here really is a resounding one, that at some point you have to be prepared to go it alone. And be autonomous, sort of irrespective of of allies that might surround you, not necessarily agreeing with your every move.
When it comes to the state of Israel, we certainly see the Maase Avot Simen Labanim. When it comes to water technology, Israel really has does follow the example of Yitzhak in terms of trying to find water sources and drinkable water and desalinization. So it seems like a good place to end. This is this parsha. I think we're going to talk more about the relationship and the tension between Yaakov and Esau as we go on. We've got, the big, we end with Yaakov, running away, thinking, hearing his brother is out to get him. Is trying to wait until Yitzhak passes away to sharpen his knives and have his revenge. So we're going to get that reunion coming up in a couple of weeks, but, in the meantime, dive in. I think we touched on so many deep things. You can really go pretty far with this week's parsha. So dive right in. The Portion Podcast is recorded in Cherry Hill, New Jersey, produced by Aaron Roller. Our theme music is The Magid's Niggin by Simply Tzfat. If you enjoy the show, please tell your friends about it any way you can. You can subscribe on Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to rate us and leave a review, and you can follow the show on Facebook. Have a good Shabbos, and remember, there is always more to learn.